Feels like I'm actually at home. You can welcome me home. Kobun Chino Roshi, as you know, some of you may know, was a unusual Zen master in that he didn't stay in one place. I guess you could say he had itchy feet. He liked to travel. And he had many students in many, many different places. Many in Europe, and had a sangha in New Mexico that's still existent, and one here in California. Taught here in the beginnings at Santa Cruz Zen Center as well. This summer has been very eventful at Chikoji. We had a memorial session and a memorial party to celebrate and remember and say thank you to Kobun Chino Roshi. We had a big bash, and it was great. It was really wonderful. Some of you were there, and it was a wonderful time. It's wonderful because unlike the Sangha of Suzuki Roshi, which is, I would say, it's more condensed, at least in the Bay Area, to some degree. It's spreading out quite a bit now. Kobun's Sangha was very much spread out, so that when all these various family members came together, it was quite touching to see that I wasn't alone, that I had Dharma sisters and Dharma brothers that I didn't even know I had. So it was great. We also had, Chikoji's been eventful because we've had a number of ordinations. Just recently, we've had four ordinations in the last month, little more than a month. And surprisingly, wonderfully, they've all been women. Had ordained four women, and myself and Vanya and Angie at Chikoji. So what's wonderful to experience if you've experienced an ordination ceremony, is that if you've taken the precepts, if you receive these vows of ethical behavior that include, that are part of the ordination process. When you experience another ordination ceremony, you retake these precepts again. You remember again. You say yes again. And it's very wonderful to come back to that beginning place where you just said, yes, I will. Yes, I will. Carry the Buddha's way. And so four times I said yes, 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 yes. I'm all yesed out. No, not really. Maybe I can say yes again. In this practice, in this way that we've encountered, that we call Buddha's way, particularly in this tradition, we have a sense of receiving something from the outside, or you could almost say walking into something almost blindly. There's a kind of choiceless choice that we sometimes feel in this practice. We don't feel like we've chosen the way, but rather that the way has chosen us. Sometimes we feel that way. Like Dogen once said that when you leave the way to the way, you attain the way. And when your treasure is left as treasure, it becomes giving. You give yourself to yourself, and you give others to others. Sometimes in the experience of this way, in the kind of modality or feeling of this way, it has a receptive quality. We receive the way. And I think that's really true. And our practice, our actual sitting practice, has these two aspects. The aspect of receiving, just as when we're noticing our breath, and we notice our breath, we receive an inhalation. We receive breath, we receive energy, we receive the whole atmosphere of the world. We take it in. We are the receptor. But there's also the other aspect that when we exhale, we release. It's active in that sense that we let go. The self, our ideas, all the drama of our life, our emotional production, we know from our practice that we can let it ride out with one exhale and let go. That's this wonderful practice we have. And at the next moment, it'll come back. Of course. But then we have this wonderful opportunity to release it again. So breath by breath we negotiate the way. When we take a vow that says, yes, this is my path. I am a student of the way. Or we may become ordained. Or we may be even thinking about choosing this as our way. Despite this kind of receptive quality that's inherent in the practice, we have to come to terms with the fact that we actually have made a choice. that we have chosen to sit down where we are. We have chosen to arrive at this particular seat. We've chosen to come to a wall and stop. Stop a production. We've made a choice. And that's what adults do. That's a sign of maturation. That's a sign of growing up. That we actually have chosen something. So I think it's okay. I think it's good for us occasionally to acknowledge that I've chosen this. I'm here. I've made a vow. And when I see other people take the precepts, I think, oh, I remember. I actually chose this path. How extraordinary. I was wondering what I was doing here. Now I know. Thank you. Can you feel that a little bit occasionally? That kind of confidence or assurance that, yes, I'm here. I've chosen this. People think it's a bib that I wear, but no, it's a rock suit. When we become ordained, we sometimes take a Buddhist name, a different name. And that new name that we have sometimes helps us to understand where we are or where we're going. It's a kind of insight from the teacher to you. And it's also a way that you can be new and fresh in the world on this way. And traditionally, the monks and the nuns would completely leave the householder life, nishraya, it's called renunciation. They would step out of their usual life and completely forget their householder life or their previous name. And take on a new existence. So nowadays in this situation, in this time, we're integrating householder life with this kind of practice within the vow, I think in a very wonderful way. But still there's a sense of taking on a new, I don't want to say persona, a new not self. Time a teacher named Gensha asked a question to his congregation. He said, I and Shakyamuni practice together. Uh, I and Shakyamuni practice together. It's kind of an audacious statement, wouldn't you say? And one of his students or fellow monks came forward and said, then who do you meet? Who do you go to meet? In other words, a student goes to meet a teacher. We call it dokusan in our tradition. Who do you have dokusan with then? If you and Shakyamuni practice together, wait a minute, who do you guys have dokusan with? You know, if you're fellow students, who do you have dokusan with? And Gensha said, Shenrang. Shenrang is Gensha's original name before he was ordained. Shenrang means something like the third son of Shen, something like that. So what Gensha said is, who does Shakyamuni and yourself go to meet? And he answered, my original self is my teacher that we both go to meet. Something similar was said by Tozan Ryokai, Dongshan Longji, the founder of this Soto thread. It's case number 45 in the Momokan. And it isn't really set like a question and answer, like some of these stories are. It's basically just a statement. And it remains unanswered in the case, in a sense. It says, even Shakyamuni and Maitreya are servants of that one. Tell me, who is that one? Even the Buddha of the present moment, of this present time, and the Buddha to be are accountable to something, to someone. So I ask you, who is that one? Any answers? And we take these wonderful precepts, and some of us put on gorgeous robes, and we follow the way. It's important for us to take care of our whole life and to bring our whole life forward. The middle way of the Buddha is sometimes partially understood as a way of moderation, not too much this way and not too much that way, not too tight and not too loose, not too much ascetic practice and not too much permissive practice. But simply a good, wholesome, middle path. And that's part of the understanding. Another part of it is that it's the non-contradiction of opposites. The middle way can be understood as the non-contradiction of opposites. So the middle way does not negate those extremes. Says that those extremes do not contradict one another or negate one another. So within light there is darkness. Within darkness there is light. So good and bad, right and wrong, parent and child, teacher and student, exist in harmonious and non-contradiction together. Well, that's another understanding of the middle way. And there's a third understanding of the middle way, and that is that the middle way is absolutely comprehensive. It does not just include intellectual understanding. It does not just include practice or meditative absorption. It does not just include being a good boy or a good girl, but it includes all those. And it does not just include that person who has achieved some practice or has taken some precepts or has done a sesshin or a practice period. But it also includes that scared little boy and girl who was hiding under the bed when they were 4 years old because they were afraid of whatever. It also includes your parents before they were born. It includes what doesn't it include? So the middle way is comprehensive. It includes your whole self. So Genshaw's answer, his original name, kind of hit the point exactly. He went back home and he said, it's there too. My origin is there. Is this? It's part of this. This person who never heard of Buddha, this person who has never heard of the way, is the one that Buddha and this venerable monk answers to, and must still be in communication with. It's said that Genshaw was, in his previous lifetime, was a fisherman, and he was at Tiantung Monastery, Tiantung Mountain, and this is conjecture on my part, but I can see him kind of looking from the mountaintop, looking down into the valley and seeing the river down in the valley and seeing a boat and perhaps a fisherman and remembering the time before he became ordained, when he was a fisherman. And he wrote this poem to, I think this was a New Year's poem to his congregation. Practicing this early morning, everything naturally is just as it is. And just the slightest step beyond the dualities of the mind, there are Buddhas appearing before us. It's like snow, pure and white, dissolving into the moving river. Shinrang, his original name, Shinrang, in his fishing boat, is gratified by this. That's a lovely poem. I don't know how many of you are familiar with snow, being impoverished people from California, but I'm from the North Country, Wisconsin, and this image is a very poignant image for me, to see snow at a certain time of the year. The water on a, particularly on rivers which are moving, but sometimes also on lakes, when the snow is falling and the river or the lake has not yet frozen, and these pure snow crystals come down into the water and completely dissolve. This pure form of a snow crystal, pure Buddha mind, the pure way, falls into the moving stream of life and dissolves. So that's Shenrang's gratification. An encouragement for those of us that have taken vows and have practiced the way to never forget to plow this activity under again and again, to go back into the world and return into our daily life's activity with the fruit of this practice. And one more thing I'd like to say, another little poem, which is actually a poem that Dogen is actually responding to this poem, Genshe's poem. And this is also a New Year's, poem. I believe it was traditional for Dogen, after he was established at Heiji, to write a New Year's poem every year, to kind of wrap up the year. Here's Dogen's response. It is natural to receive nature's body, mind so filled with delight that spring appears in the smiling. Though we are drawing oxen, Buddhas are appearing. Though snow deep and auspicious covers these mountains, I see the fishing boat. Shenrang is fishing for himself and for others. the word, Sanskrit word, chetana. It's a very broad word. It means volition. But it also means to be attracted to, or to be inclined toward. And it also means to have bright intelligence. Chetana means to choose. To choose the way. Good to remember our original vows sometimes. Story so far. Speak.
Yeah. I was curious, in the last day of this, did you meet
someone? Yeah. At the ordination.
Yeah, at the ordination. But the last time. Anyway, she was going over there. You know, some of the language I figure out and kind of which was which. But so the one about not regretting the past. What is it?
No dwelling on past mistakes.
So what would that correspond with?
It might be worded as no harboring ill will toward others or something like that, or no holding grudges or something like that. Well, that actually is the way that Comencino stated it, and he translated it different than it's come down through Suzuki Roshi. So let's see. Yeah, the sixth precept is no dwelling on past mistakes, and here's the Bodhidharma 10 precept, those kind of longer statements that were spoken by Bodhidharma, and there's various translations of them. And this is Colvin's translation of it. 6, no dwelling on past mistakes. Self-nature is mysteriously profound. In the midst of unmistakable truth, not to speak of past mistakes is called the precept of no speaking of past mistakes. So basically, he's saying both self and others is wrong. And there's another precept that I think is worded differently. It's he translates as no praise and no blame. No praise and no blame. And I know in some other translations it's no praising or building yourself up and disparaging others. So, but the way Coben has translated is no praise and no blame to both self and others. So basically the way I've understood it is that you come to a situation and you don't puff it up, which is a kind of deceit to say, whether it's yourself or if it's another person, by saying, oh, it's a big deal, you know. You know, you can actually harm someone by praising them falsely, you know, and building them up on with unrealistic ideas of themselves. And you can also, of course, harm someone by disparaging them. And so no praise and no blame kind of across the board. It's actually becomes a bigger precept in a way.
So that's wonderful what you did, because the idea is that, you know, they'll always be looking for someone to praise them rather than
have self-worth. Yeah. So they develop, otherwise they wouldn't develop confidence. They'd be looking for confirmation all the time. Precepts are a big deal. Yeah.
I one of the few times that I met Colvin was at Peter Sadlowski's ordination. And I had just been ordained weeks before. And of course, I knew Peter, you know, with the Santa Cruz.
I was just visiting Peter before I came here. We were taking out bamboo, rhizomes? Take some bamboo rhizomes back to Jigoshi.
But, you know, so the ordination ceremony that I had here was very fresh in my mind. Catherine was who I ordained with, and it was her first ordination, so she had friends of hers from San Francisco Zen Center kind of preceptors and helping out, so we really got the ceremony down. We wanted to do it just for Catherine on it, which was right. And it was pretty different.
Yeah, Colvin has that reputation for doing things different.
It was like what Jane was talking about. There were the same elements. There were just shadows of, you know, I had to sort of translate what was going on here.
Yeah.
But all the elements were there. It was like watching an interpretive dance. He moved so well, and you know, I sort of have the King James version. He was doing this interpretation of that. It's very artful and very beautiful, and I could barely recognize it. But after it missed by me,
what's interesting is that Colvin Chino Roshi, his background is very, very, very classical, actually. He came from an esteemed, almost aristocratic Soto Zen family with very high pedigree, connections to Soto Shu and everything. And he was ordained as a very young, and was trained very early And so he knows all this stuff, and apparently he helped set up Tassajara, and so he knew all the forms. So it's very interesting that of all the people that he would be the one that would be the most interpretive, I guess you'd say. Yeah. Pickled, yeah. Yeah, use that term.
And yeah. He
could expand it.
Yeah.
He could expand it.
Yeah.
That was my experience too. Every ordination ceremony, in fact, every ceremony I experienced with him was completely different. I can't, you know, it wasn't like it was. He never repeated himself.
Yeah. 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 Well, because of the family he came from, so he didn't have any choice in his life. He was just
marinated.
Yeah.
Not drunk, but marinated. I think it's our tea time, isn't it? Just about.
Thank you.